3, 2, 1, lift off.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Welcome to a History of the Space Race podcast. Episode 65, Apollo 10, Dress Rehearsal. By the end of March 1969, NASA had almost completed all of the precursor missions for landing on the moon. As I mentioned a few episodes ago, NASA had sketched out 7 mission types labeled A through G. A was an unmanned test of the command module. B was an unmanned test of the lunar module. C was a manned test of the command module. D was a manned test of the command and lunar modules. E was a test of the command and lunar module in high orbit. And F was a dress rehearsal that would involve sending a command and lunar module all the way to the moon and taking the lunar module down nearly to the surface without landing. G would be the actual moon landing. With the completion of Apollo 9 on March 13th, 1969, NASA had completed every mission type in some form except for the F and G missions, the dress rehearsal and the actual landing. In other words, NASA was done flight testing the major pieces of hardware needed to land on the moon. The next step now for Apollo 10 was the F-type mission, going all the way to the moon with a command and lunar module and taking a lunar module to just above the lunar surface. At this stage, however, NASA debated whether the dress rehearsal mission was needed at all. If they were going to take the lunar module down toward the moon, why not take it all the way down and land? A preliminary question that had to be answered was whether Apollo 10 could actually land on the moon in the first place. In the fictional alternative history of the space race, told by the TV show For All Mankind, the answer is yes. In the For All Mankind universe, Ed Baldwin is the commander of Apollo 10, and he has to restrain himself from just pushing the throttle down to land on the moon. The reality, though, was not quite that simple. The lunar module reserved for the Apollo 10 mission was known as the LM-4, and the LM-4 would have been difficult to land. LM-4 was a slightly older version of the lunar module, and it was about 3,000 pounds heavier than LM-5, the lunar module reserved for Apollo 11 and the moon landing. Some sources claim that a lunar landing would have been impossible during Apollo 10 because of the LM-4's additional weight. But most other sources I have read say a landing could have been done if NASA had measured the fuel needed to land and take off with the heavier LM-4. In fact, some sources say that NASA intentionally underfueled LM-4 to prevent the Apollo 10 astronauts from landing on the moon on their own, basically to preclude the scenario presented in For All Mankind. Now, if NASA really wanted to land on the moon one mission early during Apollo 10, NASA certainly could have made that attempt. The easiest solution would have been to swap out Apollo 10's LM-4 for Apollo 11's LM-5. The LM-5 was at Cape Canaveral, already being prepared for Apollo 11. NASA, however, had chosen affirmatively not to land on the moon during Apollo 10. NASA's flight operations team, that is the people working in mission control at the Houston Manned Spacecraft Center, argued strongly in favor of maintaining Apollo 10 as a dress rehearsal mission. First, the flight operations team argued that they and the astronauts should get experience flying the lunar module in lunar orbit. Up until now, the lunar modules had only ever been flown in Earth orbit. Operating the lightweight lunar module in lunar orbit would be different due to the moon's uneven gravity field. Second, the flight operations team wanted experience tracking and communicating with two manned spacecraft in lunar orbit, yet another situation that NASA had never experienced before. In the end, though, the argument most in favor of performing a dress rehearsal during Apollo 10 came down to this. The actual moon landing mission should involve the fewest number of firsts. Whatever could be attempted before the Apollo 11 mission should be attempted so that the number of unknowns for the landing was an absolute minimum. The moon landing should not be a gamble if they could help it. So while there were those in NASA who favored moving ahead with a moon landing now, such as the director of the Office of Manned Spaceflight, George Miller, NASA decided to proceed with the dress rehearsal. The astronauts selected for the dress rehearsal mission were Thomas Stafford, John Young, and Eugene Cernan. Stafford was Apollo 10's commander. He had quite a bit of experience at this point, having flown on Gemini 6, the long-duration flight of 14 days, and Gemini 9, the failed attempt to dock with the Augmented Docking Target Adapter, or the Angry Alligator. John Young was the command module pilot. Young had flown on Gemini 3, the first manned Gemini mission, and Gemini 10, the mission that performed a double rendezvous and multiple EVAs. Eugene Cernan was the lunar module pilot. Cernan had been Stafford's co-pilot on Gemini 9 in the docking adapter mission. Like the astronauts from Apollo 9, the crew of Apollo 10 chose the call signs for the command and lunar modules. They decided to call the command module Charlie Brown, the main character from the Peanuts cartoon strip, and the lunar module was named after Charlie Brown's dog, Snoopy. The origin of the names apparently came from the thinking that the lunar module would be snooping the moon for the Apollo 11 landing site. So the lunar module was named first for Snoopy. Charlie Brown naturally followed for the command module. The astronauts also wanted to use the call sign Snoopy and a nod to those who helped prepare for their mission. So this second explanation for the call sign requires a little bit of unpacking. After the Apollo 1 fire in January 1967, NASA began emphasizing more than ever before the importance of quality control. NASA spread that message not only to its employees, but to the employees of its contractors and subcontractors. NASA's Public Affairs Office in the Manned Spacecraft Center decided to further this message by issuing an award for employees and contractors who demonstrated distinguished service, particularly in the areas of quality control and safety. With the permission of Charles Schulz, the author of the Peanuts comic strip, the Public Affairs Office decided that the award should be a silver pin in the shape of Snoopy wearing a spacesuit. For followers of the comic strip, the shape of the pin was not that strange. In the comic, Snoopy had gone to the moon the previous year. The award is known as the Silver Snoopy Award, and NASA still awards it today. So, by naming the lunar module Snoopy, the astronauts were paying homage to the many engineers, technicians, and others who were helping them get to the moon. NASA's Public Affairs Office at headquarters, however, was not happy. Once again, the astronauts had chosen an undignified name for the spacecraft, like the choice of Gumdrop and Spider for Apollo 9 and Molly Brown for Gemini 3. Moreover, Charlie Brown was mostly a failure in the cartoon strip, and the Public Affairs Office at headquarters feared associating Apollo 10 with that failure. But NASA headquarters would not get to change the name this time. For one thing, the whole Snoopy thing had kind of come from one of their own at the Public Affairs Office at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston. On top of that, when the public learned of the call signs, they could not be withdrawn. The public was infatuated with the well-known cartoon characters, so the fight over the call signs will be continued for another day. On May 18, 1969, NASA launched Apollo 10. The launch happened only 2 months after Apollo 9. Underlining the rapid pace of the missions, Apollo 11 was already being prepared on the launch pad. In fact, Apollo 10 took off from Launch Pad 39B at the Kennedy Space Center because Launch Pad 39A was already occupied with preparations for Apollo 11. The trip to space went well. As in the past, the astronauts encountered some pogo during the second stage, but nothing unexpected. Then, for the second time in history, the third stage of the Saturn V, the S4B, ignited in Earth orbit to perform the translunar injection maneuver, sending Apollo 10 toward the moon. Once the translunar injection maneuver was complete, John Young separated the command and service module from the S4B. He then turned the ship's attitude around 180 degrees and went back to the S4B to dock with the lunar module. Young then pulled the lunar module out of the S4B, and together the command and lunar modules left the S4B and were on their way to the moon. Apollo 10 would take about 3 days to get to the moon. The journey to the moon was relatively uneventful, except for some complications with the crew's water supply. The drinking water was chlorinated. Unfortunately, the first batch of drinking water received double the usual dose of chlorine. The water was drinkable, but it had an odd taste. Mission Control advised that the astronauts should place the water in a bag and then try to spin the bag to separate the gas from the water. The gas would separate, but it would then settle at the bottom of the bag and then remix with the water, so the process didn't really work. Besides a foul taste, the extra chlorinated water created gas pains and cramps for the astronauts and fears of diarrhea in space. This in turn affected the astronauts' appetite. So overall, the journey out to the moon was not a fun one. Apollo 10 was on a trajectory to bring the spacecraft to within 110 kilometers of the lunar surface. Unlike Apollo 8, the moon was in such a position that the crew of Apollo 10 was able to see the moon on their way there. As Apollo 10 got close to the moon, Young fired the service module engine for about 6 minutes, slowing the spacecraft down enough to be captured by the moon's gravity. After settling down into lunar orbit for about 6 hours, Thomas Stafford and Eugene Cernan began preparing the lunar module. They then took a rest period before putting on their pressure suits and getting ready to separate the lunar module from the command module. For a moment, there was a fear that undocking the lunar module would damage the spacecraft and prevent redocking. This fear arose from the realization that the two spacecraft had misaligned by about 3 degrees when they docked the first time. If the spacecraft were damaged undocking, the only way for Stafford and Cernan to get back to the command module would be via an EVA outside the spacecraft. Mission Control eventually concluded that the misalignment, however, was within an acceptable degree of tolerance, and no serious damage would result from the undocking. So Charlie Brown, the command module, and Snoopy, the lunar module, separated. Charlie Brown backed away and Snoopy began its descent toward the moon. At this point, Young, inside Charlie Brown, became the first astronaut in a solo flight around the moon. The plan was for Snoopy to descend to an altitude of about 14.5 kilometers above the lunar surface, or just under 9 miles. The 14.5 kilometers was a perfect distance for the dress rehearsal. This was the highest altitude at which the lunar module's ground radar could be used to scan the lunar surface. It was the altitude to fire the descent engine, and it was the lowest altitude that Charlie Brown could come down if Snoopy needed rescuing. The descent down to the moon took about an hour. During this time, NASA learned, for the first time, how to operate two manned spacecraft in lunar orbit. Stafford and Cernan inside Snoopy had accidentally left their mic open, so Young inside Charlie Brown heard everything. Young reported that this was actually helpful for him to keep tabs on Snoopy, but he noted that when he spoke to Snoopy, he could hear feedback. This was one of those things that NASA would have to fix for Apollo 11. Inside Snoopy, Stafford and Cernan were busy taking pictures of the lunar surface, checking visibility from inside the lunar module, and testing the landing radar. All of this worked fine, except Cernan's camera eventually stopped working, so all he could do was look out at the scenery. After about an hour, it was time for Stafford and Cernan to drop the descent stage of the lunar module and fire up the ascent stage to get back to Charlie Brown. Right before they dropped the descent stage, however, Snoopy flipped over as Cernan momentarily lost control. The descent stage then separated, and as the ascent stage flipped over, the astronauts could see the descent stage go by the window. The incident was very brief, only seconds long. Cernan recovered control of Snoopy and corrected the spacecraft's attitude. During this brief scare, however, there was a bit of cussing into the open mic being broadcast to a live television audience. Here, take a listen.
Okay, you ready?
Okay, hold it. Okay, go.
Ready?
Thrust that. Hold it. Thrust that. Okay, ready? Stay.
Okay.
Together lock. Good things. God damn.
Okay, let's... didn't burn any eggs, babe.
You can barely hear it in the audio, but right after the staging, when the spacecraft flipped over, Cernan says, "Son of a bitch." And then he says, "Goddamn," repeatedly. The swearing led to a few complaints back home by the morality police. Incidentally, though, if you look up the transcript for the mission like I did, you will quickly see that passing swear words around was not an uncommon thing. They also oddly called each other babe a lot. Overall, however, the temporary loss of control over Snoopy was relatively minor. In fact, I've included a link in a video in the blog post associated with this episode where you can see the television feed from Snoopy when Cernan lost control. You'll be able to see for yourself that the incident passes quite quickly. The incident itself had been caused by the astronauts accidentally flipping the switch to turn on the automatic abort system. The abort system was designed to take the astronauts back to the command module if there was a problem during the descent. As part of the automated abort process, the lunar module activates its radar to find the command module. The computer on board will then take that radar data to plot a course back to the command module, and the ascent stage engine will then fire. In this case, because the astronauts had accidentally turned the automated abort system on, Snoopy turned on its radar and started looking for the command module, causing the spacecraft to roll. One thing that a close examination of the space race really shows is that automated systems in the 1960s can be a true headache. I have mentioned this once before, much earlier in the podcast, when I discussed the Mercury program. Automated systems can trigger in unexpected circumstances, leading to a sequence of totally unintended events. The Mercury Redstone 1 launch was a prime example. I am emphasizing this point again, however, because the lunar module's automated abort system will cause problems one more time. It will nearly put a premature end to Apollo 11 when Neil Armstrong was only about 5,000 feet above the lunar surface. Getting back to Apollo 10, however, Snoopy recovered and made its way back to Charlie Brown. The two spacecraft then docked. These were yet another historic set of achievements. This was the first lunar orbital rendezvous and docking. Lunar orbital rendezvous, which had been the subject of intense debate in NASA in 1961, was finally achieved in 1969. By now, NASA had achieved rendezvous so many times that this maneuver, which had been so controversial not that long ago, seemed routine the first time it was performed. Snoopy's entire solo mission had lasted a total of about 8 hours. Stafford and Cernan then crawled through the docking tunnel from Snoopy back to Charlie Brown. They then closed the tunnel and cut Snoopy loose. Mission Control then remotely ordered the ascent engine to fire until depletion, sending Snoopy's ascent stage away from the moon and into heliocentric orbit. That is not the end of the story to the pioneering Snoopy. In 2011, some astronomers looking for Snoopy's ascent stage believe they found it in heliocentric orbit. With 98% certainty, these astronomers believe that a tiny object labeled 2018 AV2 is the Snoopy ascent stage. The ascent stage would be the only previously manned spacecraft to still be in space. Except, perhaps, maybe, the Apollo 11 lunar module. Snoopy's descent stage is widely believed to have crashed on the lunar surface. Inside Charlie Brown, the astronauts now prepared to leave lunar orbit. As they did so, however, they encountered an unexpected problem.
Oh, who did it?
Did what?
Who did it? Give me a napkin quick. There's a turkey.
I didn't do it. It ain't one of mine.
I don't think it's one of mine.
Mine was a little more sticky than this.
God almighty.
You heard that right. Stafford asked for a napkin because he saw a turd floating in the cabin. That was not the end of the floating stool, however. A few minutes after Stafford secured the first turd, this happened.
Here's another goddamn turd. What's the matter with you guys? Here, give me a...
Okay, before we see, I sure didn't know I was sitting on the floor.
Did it just float their ass?
Yeah.
Mine was stickier than that.
Mine was too. It hit that bag right
in. Mine was nice and soft.
Dang.
I don't know who that is. I can either claim it or disclaim it.
Yep, that's right. As they were talking through procedures for leaving lunar orbit, Cernan spotted a second turd. To this day, it remains unclear who was responsible for the two floating stools, or whether they belonged to two different astronauts. Stafford, Young, and Cernan have all denied that it was them. It is quite plausible that this was not actually a practical joke by anyone. The sanitation system for solid waste, shall we say, was not great during the Apollo era. Basically, the astronauts took a plastic bag and some tape. They would then tape the sides of the bag open by attaching the ends of the tape to their buttocks. Then they would do their business. So it is quite possible that in this environment, one or two stools got loose of the bag when one of the astronauts tried to take or detach the bag from their buttocks to secure it. After the infamous turd incident, all that was left of the mission was to return home. The journey home took about 42 hours, which was unusually fast. Normally, the journey should take about 56 hours, but NASA chose a shorter trajectory to bring Apollo 10 home. For this reason, Apollo 10 to this day maintains the record for the fastest that any human has ever traveled, at 24,791 miles per hour relative to the Earth. This is because during the journey home, Apollo 10 was effectively falling back to Earth. On May 26, 1969, Charlie Brown re-entered the atmosphere and splashed down in the Pacific Ocean about 700 kilometers off the coast of Samoa. Apollo 10 was another stunning success for NASA that continued the rapid pace toward a moon landing. Apollo 10 proved that the Lunar Orbital Rendezvous mission profile that NASA selected all the way back in July 1962 worked. The mission also proved that the lunar module worked in the lunar environment. The guidance controls, radar, communications, and other mission systems were all clear. All that was left now was to actually land on the moon with Apollo 11, which was already being prepared on Launch Pad 39A at the Kennedy Space Center. Before I get to Apollo 11, however, I want to take us back to the Soviet Union. Because while NASA is suddenly moving quickly toward a moon landing, the Soviet Union's space program is also moving at breakneck speeds in the first months of 1969. The N-1 rocket finally enters flight testing, and the Soviet Union starts launching unmanned lunar sample retrieval missions to the moon. I'll cover that next time.